Okay, chapter 14, we're seeing Paul in the midst of his first journey. What is the region that Paul is doing this teaching? What region is it?
Asia Minor.
No, they're not in Asia Minor. That would be the second journey. They're in Galatia. Okay, so this is a little short one kind of thing. That's where they got a U-shape. Down through Cyprus, and they've gone up through Pamphylia, up to Antioch, up Pisidia, and then working their way over. So in chapter 14, they've gone from Antioch to Pisidia, now they've come over to Iconium. They're actually going east again, so they're making this kind of circle, but then they're going to round back out. If you can't visualize that in your mind, please look at the map in the back of your Bible. If you don't have a map in the back of your Bible, get a Bible that has a map in the back of your Bible. Something like that. So, but look at that and notice that they're heading east, then over to Iconium from Antioch of Pisidia. And they're going to go Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and then backtrack through there and then back to Antioch. And we'll try to see most of that, if not all of that, this morning. That's my hope. All right, we've noticed that at the end of chapter 13, guess what's happening? Jews are inciting people. They're stirring up trouble. This is one of the things that Theophilus would be noting carefully, that the problems that are taking place with Christianity in different places is not the fault of Christianity. It's the fault of those who are specifically Jews who are upset and stirring people up. So you see it again at Iconium. Chapter 14, 1. Now at Iconium they entered together into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So they remained for a long time, speaking boldly for the Lord, who bore witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. When an attempt was made by both Gentiles and Jews with their rulers to mistreat them and to stone them, they learned of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding country. And there they continued to preach the gospel. Okay, take a note there as to what their reaction is when some of these unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their mind against the brothers. What's their reaction? Yeah, they just keep right on doing it. they preach more boldly and they just keep on preaching. When do they draw the line and leave? Yeah, when they're about to be so, when violence is taking place. Okay, what would you say that teaches us?
There's a stopping point.
you're not going to do anything to spread the gospel if you're dead. Yeah.
If you're dead, you can't spread the gospel. And the Lord, though a Christian needs to be ready to be persecuted, the Lord didn't expect you to not get out of there if you can see it coming.
Don't get any points for a persecution
complex. Yeah, you don't get any points for a persecution complex. That's exactly right. So it's okay to skedaddle when you can see this kind of violence taking place. Now, did Jesus teach that principle somewhere? I'm glad, you know, Patrick, it feels like it, yeah, that he did, especially since I asked the question. It does feel like that he did. Can somebody at least paraphrase what he said? That is true in the limited commission when he sent them out, that if they don't receive you, shake your dust off your feet. But there's another case in which he actually refers to violence and that you do not need to continue trying to preach to somebody who is going to be violent.
Well, you gave an example when you left Nazareth, they're going to throw him over the cliff.
Yeah, he just walked out. course, that's pretty easy for him to do. We probably might not have been able to just walk off, but it was not his time. Can I give you a second hint? The Sermon on the Mount here. Okay. That's a good one. Wasn't one I was thinking of, but Matthew 10. If he persecutes you in one town, go to the next, you know. All right. Cast not your pearls before swine, lest they turn and rend you, or give what which is holy to the dogs, lest they turn and destroy you and rend you. See, you have to know when a person's a hog or a dog. All right? To quote an old preacher that always cracked me up, you know, you got to know when a person's a hog or a dog. So.
You probably shouldn't tell them if you make that decision.
No, you don't tell them that. You
it won't help you with the problem
of persecution. That's exactly right. So, no, there's a perception, of course. Well, they hear of this plot in order to kill them. You see Paul doing this. We saw Paul doing this already when he was at Damascus, and he was preaching the gospel right after he became a Christian, remember? And he was at Damascus, and the king of the city put out a warrant for his arrest. They were going to take him, etc., and the brethren did what? Let him down over the wall by night in a basket and allowed him to escape. So even when it was a governmental authority, and he knew it was just simply for a reason to kill him or whatever, he just takes off. So that's that. So interesting how that's, I think that's an interesting part of what you see in the spreading of the gospel, where there is obviously a time when you have no choice, and like Paul gets arrested, etc., and so you are going to stand for Christ even in the midst of persecution. But at the other hand, you're not just going to stick around if it's possible to get away. All right? Any other thoughts on that?
Also, Matthew 5:39,
okay,
resist not him
that
is evil.
Okay, resist not. Yeah, resist not him who's evil. If somebody slaps you on your right cheek, get left also. That's right. Yeah, you're not going to. Yeah, you're not going to get in a punching out fight. You're not going to do all of that. You're just going to. We don't take physical means to protect the kingdom of God or ourselves in the kingdom of God.
Which has been over the history of the world is religion is the reason they would go to wars.
I know. Yeah, it's and this is a misunderstanding. You know, more basically and foundationally, and sometimes this is important to talk about with somebody you're teaching, but more foundationally, the misunderstanding is misunderstanding the kingdom. It's not a physical kingdom. You're not defending a physical kingdom or a physical church or something like that. This is the foolishness of the Crusades. We're going to go drive the Muslims out of the Holy Land, especially. You're not even smart enough to realize God didn't think it was Holy Land. So, God was the cause for the Jews being run off that land, and you know, on and on and on and on it could go. But that's one of the major problems, and that's problem has gone on for a long time. People not understanding that the kingdom is not physical. Yeah, it was really just an excuse to plunder, which has given Christianity a bad name. These weren't even Christians doing that. That's exactly right. Okay, notice their reaction to this. You know, they speak boldly. Notice they bear witness that God bears witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. Now, you get a little picture, and again, if you're teaching somebody, this is something that you want to bring up. This is the reason for the signs and wonders. And we've already seen that. You would have already noted that with people all the way back in chapter 2. Why did the apostles speak in other languages? Because it was a sign to these Jews that they are now speaking from God and that they needed to listen. And so hear the same thing. God is granting signs and wonders in order to bear witness that what they're preaching is true. Okay? And that's going to come back, by the way, in chapter 15 when Paul and Barnabas are going to relate the fact that they taught Gentiles without circumcision. And God was putting a stamp of approval on it by giving them signs and wonders. Therefore, you don't need to preach circumcision to Gentiles. See, so that's an important little statement. Sometimes we read through these things, we just go too quickly and not notice some of the importance there. Thoughts on that? Understand that? Yeah.
I think it's interesting that it says he granted them signs and wonders. I think frequently we understand or we indicate that the miraculous works of the Spirit, the apostles were just given the ability to do them, and they could do them whenever they wanted.
Indiscriminately.
Once they got that power, they could heal whoever they wanted. They could turn things into wine or bread or all the things. But here and in some other places, to me, it makes clear that they could only do them when the Lord wanted them to, when the Spirit deemed that this was a time for miraculous confirmation. And they just didn't walk around the street just...
Yeah.
Unlike Jesus, who people touched him and they were healed. Right?
Well, there were some occasions when even the shadow of Peter, remember, passed by, and that so there would be occasions. But I think your principle is still correct that God had to grant it to certain situations. In 2 Timothy, you will learn that Paul left Trophimus sick at Miletus. In fact, Patrick wrote a little article about it in the bulletin this morning. One of the one time in 365, I don't know, bulletins I've read, but. No, just kidding. Just
we appreciate you not doing it.
That's right. No, but pointed out, Paul said, I hope you get well. See you later. But left him there, and he doesn't do anything about it.
Or Paul could have asked one of the folks that can heal people to take the thorn from his flesh, right?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, take the thorn from his flesh. It's the same thing. And you have the situation in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, where one is giving a prophecy, and then the scripture says, and then a prophecy is given to somebody who's sitting by. In other words, God's going, about time for that guy to be quiet. I'm giving another prophecy, and he's supposed to stand up and speak now. So, of course, we don't know the ins and outs of how God makes that decision, but I think you're correct that it wasn't just, I have this power, and I can just do however I want with it, whenever I want with it. Epaphroditus sick unto death. Of course, Paul wasn't near him at that. Well, doesn't seem to be, but he's on his journey to Paul. But at any rate, anyway, very, very good. So those are some of the things that you notice. Notice that they, I think this little statement, they fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities like Iconia, and to the surrounding country. So sometimes Luke is highlighting specific cities, but he threw that in there to point out that Paul is not just teaching in the cities, but they're going to the surrounding country as they're traveling. They're running into, there's little towns, by the way, just all along that Roman road, and so they might be talking in that. Don, did you say something? Oh, no, okay. I thought you were waving at me, so I didn't. Hello. Okay. Going on to verse 9. Now at Lystra there was a man sitting who could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and had never walked. Okay, let's just stop. Does this remind you of anything in the book of Acts?
Yes.
What's it remind you of?
The lame man at the school.
Acts chapter 3. The lame man in Acts 3, and Peter and John heal the lame man who had never walked. Okay, I want you to see the balance. And so you can see this a lot here. With Paul, you're going to see Paul doing things, and why is Luke bringing it up? Because you see showing Paul is doing things that are exactly like Peter is doing things. Why is that important? It confirms the message, but there's something more important to the balance.
That if Paul is the apostle for the Gentiles don't get a lesser, weaker
That's right. Both these apostles, an apostle to the Gentiles, an apostle to the Jews, and Paul is doing equally powerful miracles with the Gentiles, just as Peter did with the Jews. That's incredibly important. It's important for Theophilus to know that if I decide to become a Christian, I'm not going to be a lesser guy in the kingdom with the Jews, etc., that there's an equality, but it's important just for everyone who's going to read Luke's letter that there isn't someone lesser. Look, I just got through, just in the from January to March, spending I don't know how many, incredible number of hours with a man who came to our downtown meetup, and we studied. One of the most knowledgeable guy I've ever been with, as far as somebody who was not a Christian yet. But we went round and round and round on whether or not a person actually needs to be baptized to be saved. And he finally admitted at the very end, now listen to it, and this is unfortunately becoming more popular. I heard about it back in the 70s, ran into some, and now I'm running into it again. He said, well, Peter didn't understand, and Paul had to correct him on the salvation thing, and Paul taught a salvation by grace, and Peter was just teaching those Jews, and they needed rituals in order to understand. You know, the Jews were really dumb, apparently, which they weren't, but that was his deal. And that Paul came along and I said, well, then why was he baptizing? And he never would answer that. Well, the baptism Paul was doing, it was just showing that they had repented. It's really just repentance. I agree, but every time you would go to a text where Paul would talk about baptism, like Romans 6 or something like that, He would actually deny that Paul was literally referring to a physical baptism, that this was just a figure of speech for coming to Christ and repenting. Anyway, I wanted to point that out just to say there's an opposite, where in this period of time, the concern is Paul equal to Peter? This guy's turning around and reversing that and saying, is Peter as good as Paul? As if they're both teaching something different. So, you know, you just basically, you know, throw out 1st and 2nd Peter. You know, Peter said baptism now saves you, just like the water of the flood. But I want to make you aware of that because, again, in your sharing the gospel, in your conversations with people, you may run into this guy's very, very energetic. He has podcasts all over the internet. He travels teaching this, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just interesting to see that. By the way, there was a movie made back somewhere in the 60s or 70s. I never watched the whole thing, couldn't stand it. But where Paul, the same thing, same principle, Paul had to come along and fix Peter. He just, you know, was locked in this Jewish ritualism. And Paul's preaching a grace only, and Peter just doesn't get it. So, and Paul and Peter were always battling. Well, Galatians 2 says they weren't. They met together and gave each other the right hand of fellowship, and one would teach the Jews and one would teach the Gentiles.
How did you conclude that, or did you?
How we concluded it? We concluded it with he didn't see it, and he wasn't going to see it. So,
adios.
That's right. Yeah, you get to the point where, okay, we've said everything, and you're, you know, he just kept coming back with the same old thing. Yeah, so yeah, it was no use continuing. So when he became, when I decided to cut it off, is when he became dishonest with the text, and that was at that point when he started saying that Peter wasn't equal to Paul, and that Peter was teaching a different gospel. That's when I said, okay, you are perfectly denying what Galatians 2 says. And he said, no, I'm not. Well, yeah, you are. So there you go. Yeah, that was it. But anyway, just to give you an idea, Tim.
I mean, Peter's the one who refers to Paul, right?
Yes. He would probably say that by the time Peter wrote 2 Peter, that Peter was getting it, you know, maybe, something like that, yeah. But basically, see, this happens a lot. Basically, what he was doing is discounting Acts. It's if we can get Acts out. Y'all would be very, very surprised at how few people in denominations, evangelical world, etc., know a bloomin' thing about the book of Acts. It's not studied. And I run into that over and over and over again. Louis and Rebecca, they visit here with all the kids a year or so ago. Rebecca is very knowledgeable in the Bible, attended evangelical churches for years and years and years, didn't hardly know a thing about Acts. And she knew everything else in the Bible, didn't hardly know anything about Acts, had not come to grips with it. Well, it's just not taught. And so, anyway, Teresa, back when we were in Arkansas, was invited by an evangelical lady to go to their women's Acts class during the week. And the lady stood up, and the first thing she said is, "You will not in this class, and we will not in this class, be talking about any denominational views, any creeds. We're only going to look at the Bible, and that's it. Do not make comments about your creed, your belief, your doctrines, etc. Only the text. That's it." Got to Acts 2:38, Teresa, and she just totally ran right over it. She as the old saying went, observed the Passover, went right over it. Teresa raised her hand and said, "Well, what about the statement that baptism forgiveness of sins? I told you we would not bring up church doctrines here." And that was the end. So it's that kind of thing that takes place over and over again, just a discounting of certain parts of the Bible that they can't account for, and that's the problem. Anyway, be prepared for it, not in an antagonistic way, but be prepared for it. Think about in your mind how you would understand or respond in those situations. So going on to verse 8. Now at Lystra, there was a man, we did this sitting at his feet, could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and never walked. He listened to Paul speaking, and Paul, looking intently at him and seeing that he had faith to be made well, said in a loud voice, "Stand upright on your feet." Why does he say it in a loud voice? Yeah, he wants everybody to hear this. It's not like he goes up and goes, "Hey, go ahead and stand up. I'm going to, you know, just kind of walk over there." No, there's a point of this. He wants to get people seeing what's going on here so that he's going to have an opportunity to teach. So you can just see the boldness and the way that Paul stands and says this with a very, very loud voice. And he sprang up and began walking. What should impress you about that? Yeah, he does. He did not have to go to therapy. That's exactly right. It was not necessary, you know. He had to learn how to walk. He didn't, and he sprang up. I mean, this is an instantaneous, absolute, complete miracle. And you can imagine, what did this man's feet and legs look like? They're about this big around. Because there's no muscle tone, there's nothing been there, he's never used them. And so this would be a very, very grotesque looking set of legs and feet. And everything becomes muscular, and he stands up and he walks and he jumps. This is just what you saw back in Acts chapter 3.
Paul, looking at him, and saw his faith.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can't see my faith looking, but he somehow saw that. It's a question. You know, you wonder what he was seeing there. But at any rate, for those of us who are older and used to watch back in the 60s and 70s, the Oral Roberts and so many others that would go across the country doing big healing services. And I remember when I, you know, would every once in a while be sick and couldn't go to church Sunday morning, I'd turn on Oral Roberts and watch him knock people down. And he'd literally slap them in the head and they'd fall down. And somehow they got well by falling down. And then occasionally he'd lift somebody up out of a wheelchair or something like that. So the hocus pocus of that, by the way, in case you're wondering, and this is well known, but the hocus pocus about that whole thing is when he would go someplace, and this is true of all the other miracle workers, they'd go someplace and they wouldn't open the doors right away. And so they'd have a line outside to be a mile long waiting for them to open the doors. And that was done intentionally because then they'd send out their workers and they would take wheelchairs and go out and find people in the line who said, yeah, I need to sit down, you know, because they'd be, I'm kind of sick and I'm coming to be healed and I just need to sit down. And they'd put him in these wheelchairs. And then they'd wheel them in to a certain section. And then the person, the healer, would go, somebody over here in the wheelchair section has just been healed. Stand up. And they'd stand up out of a wheelchair. And everybody would go, oh. Well, they could stand up anyway. That was not the issue. No, they don't let them in. Yeah, anybody has an organic sickness, they put them in another room. And Oral Roberts, they would have them in another room. And after the whole healing ceremony, he'd come by and pray for them and then leave. But nobody got well at those. That's the pattern. So anyway, I'm not telling you this to make fun of that or anything else. I'm telling you this so that you're aware when somebody says, but I've seen this or something like this. Well, there's a lot of sleight of hand that goes on in these miracle ceremonies. There was a movie done back again in probably 80s, I think it was, called Marjo. Anybody remember it? Wasn't in theaters very long. He got whacked, but Marjo was a guy who was, when he was 4 years old, his parents used him as a 4-year-old preacher in Pentecostal churches. And they made tons and tons of money. Marjo turned, because of his experience with his parents, he turned atheist. And he turned around and decided he'd make a movie about the farce that was going on. And he pretended to be a Pentecostal preacher, and he toured the country and filming everything he was doing. And filming the back room of them gathering in the money that he got and filming how he would pretend to heal people and pray for people and do the whole thing. And he's a very charismatic guy, and he put it in, and he got into the theaters very, very briefly and then got thrown out. But anyway, he tried to his best to expose the farce that was going on. There's a lot of it, and you notice it, just you don't see too much of it anymore. I think people kind of wised up a bit. But Marjo Gorder, yeah. Okay, so going on then in verse 11, and when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in Lyconian, so Paul wouldn't have understood them, the gods have come down to us in likeness of men. Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance to the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice to the crowds. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard of it, they tore their garments and rushed into the crowd, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not leave himself without witness. He did good, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them." Okay, so here's quite a scene. You'll realize, of course, that Paul now is in a whole different situation. He's not teaching Jews. In fact, as he comes to Lystra, there's no mention of a synagogue. How many Jewish men did you have to have a synagogue? 10. Had to have 10 Jewish men to have a synagogue, And so there's no synagogue in the city. Didn't even have evidence of any Jews at all, as a matter of fact, in the city. And so these are total pagans. And the healing and all this just causes them to think this is Zeus and Hermes. Zeus in the Greek gods was the greatest of all the gods. Hermes is his speaker or his messenger and son. And so Barnabas may have been the quieter one. And so, the quieter one, he must be the real big cheese here. So they call him Zeus. And then Hermes, that's where we get the word hermeneutic, right? Interpreter, to interpret, to give message. And so there's the idea of Paul being called that. And why in verse 14 does he refer to Barnabas as in one of the apostles? Yeah, he was sent out from Antioch. So there in the scriptures, there's apostles of men and there's apostles of Christ. Okay, Galatians chapter 1, verse 1, Paul actually makes the differentiation. Paul, an apostle, not of men, but of Jesus Christ. Okay, so there is a difference. The word will be used in other places and just translated messenger, whereas people like Epaphroditus was an apostle or a messenger of the churches. So if a church sent you out, you became one who had a purpose that way. Got that? Any questions? Tim?
Just like the word deacon, I mean, you have...
Exactly.
Anybody can be a servant and they're a deacon in that sense.
Right.
That's what the word was, but then there's the office of the deacon.
Yeah, that's exactly. Greek word diakonos is used both as just a common servant and then also as one who would have more of what we would call an office or a work of a deacon appointed that way in a church. So there's that differentiation too. Angel is the same way. Word angel, angelos, is translated as an angel that is like an angel from heaven, but then there's also those again who are messengers, who are like John the Baptist. The angelos is referred, John the Baptist is referred to. Yep. One who was sent from God, etc. So there's people who aren't angelic who are still considered in the Greek that way. That would be the definition. So you kind of have to be aware of those things. By the way, just in passing, lots of times people are confused about a disciple and an apostle, the difference between the two. So you always have to point that out. Apostles, obviously, appointed by Jesus Christ. Disciples are those who are followers of Christ and more generic. All right, so notice how Paul gives the answer here in verse 15. We also are men of like nature with you. You can imagine how disappointed they would be to hear this. No, we're really hoping that you were gods. And so this is real hard for them. They're going to be convinced that they're men of like nature in just a moment when some come and stir them up and they stone them. But one of the things I think is always important to learn here, Paul, as we said, is down in verse 19, he's going to go ahead. They're going to stone him. When somebody is praising you, be careful. Watch out for that person. If they're overly, it's one thing to say, hey, really, you're doing a good job. It's another thing to just go, oh, you are so amazing. You are just something else.
You've never had that happen, have you?
Actually, amazingly, I have a few times and I run away. And I was like, what? You need to talk to my wife is what my answer always. You need to talk to my wife. You know, they'll bring you down a notch or two. But those are the kinds of people that will turn and stone you the next day because you didn't meet up to their godlike figure that they wanted to put you on this platform. So always be aware of that. Okay, so anyway, so notice we're like nature as you, and we bring good news. Here's the gospel message that you should turn from these vain things. Word vain, worthless things. Imagine he is talking to these pagans who have honored these gods, and Paul's going, no, this is worthless. This is absolutely worthless. This is not going to do you any good at all to get you right with God, the true and living God. Then he goes on to say, turn from these vain things to a living God. And notice he's the creator of everything. He made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them. How is that different than the Greek gods? Yeah, they had gods over all these different things. You know, there's the God of the sea, there's the God of the heavens, there's the God of the sky, there's the God of the, you know, sun god, there's all these different gods. So he's saying, no, there's one God who is over all. He's created all these things. And then he actually says, in past generations he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not leave them without witness. So what does it mean he, in past generations, allowed the nations to walk in all their own ways? What is the idea there?
He gave the Jews the revelation of the law. And we might assume that the patriarchs passed away. We don't know. We spoke of patriarchs, but these people just had... Well, I think somewhere it speaks of a law of nature or innate conscience.
Romans, yeah, Romans 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he wasn't dealing directly and specifically with these folks anymore.
Okay, I think one of the points that we want to come away is, yes, he wasn't dealing as directly and specifically as he does to the Jews. I think that's part of the answer, Sloan. Okay, so everybody knows God in the beginning, and then there's an individuality of nations, and God is now has the plan of bringing them all back together. Okay, good. Is the text saying that, God just, as he says, allowed all the nations to walk in their own way? So, you know, all those people, they can... You know, they'll just be saved. He just allowed all that to happen, and now he's not going to allow it to happen anymore. Now he's doing something about it.
Verse 7. If you didn't have verse 17, it'd definitely be easier to think that's what he means. But verse 17, when it makes clear that they had witness,
they should have known.
They should have known something. Now here, he doesn't necessarily clarify what having a witness means. I think Dwayne's comment about Romans illuminates what having a witness here means. And I think this is one of those times where if you read Acts and you say, well, these are the words he said, and that this is all that he said,
yeah,
it leaves you with the wrong impression.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a time we need to acknowledge Acts is a, except for some direct quotes, is a historical paraphrase of
right.
what happened.
Right.
And you need to go to places like Romans 1 and 2 to understand when Paul says, well, there was a witness. He doesn't say anything else here about it. But in Romans 1 and 2, he says, if people didn't listen to the witness,
yeah,
they were condemned. It didn't matter that they didn't have all the revelation of God. We don't understand exactly what that means. We don't have to understand exactly what that means. But it certainly would be a perversion,
yeah,
to take this and say, well, they were allowed to do whatever they want, so we're all allowed to do whatever we want.
And Romans 1 is the key here. Okay, I think that's the key. So in Romans 1, verse 18 down through verse 32, Paul is going to give a very, very specific analysis of this particular statement. He's going to show that God did not leave them without witness, and as a matter of fact, although they knew God, verse 21 of Romans 1, although they knew God, they did not want to have God in their thinking, and they were not thankful, and they turned away from him, and etc. And in fact, we could go back and list some prophets in the Old Testament that are actually pretty latter-day prophets that were prophets to Gentile nations, like who? Jonah. Who else?
I think
Daniel, personally. Daniel, definitely. Daniel is a prophet into the Gentile nations. He is primarily a Gentile prophet to Gentiles. Joel has prophecies about the nations, exactly. Name another.
Melchizedek.
Pardon? Melchizedek is a priest and certainly a king and prophet, exactly.
His Gentiles he lives with.
He goes to. Yeah, Elijah goes to Gentiles. That's right. Okay. Can we get another literary prophet?
Nahum,
Obadiah, Zephaniah mentions them. Amos, first part of Amos has prophecies about and to the foreign nations. Isaiah has a large section that we've just finished up on our Sunday night. Which, by the way, get excited for tonight. Isaiah 23 and 24 is going to send you to the moon.
Were you disappointed in us that we haven't said Isaiah and you had to bring it
up? I'm not. Okay. You know, I'm used to it.
Disappointed and not surprised.
Exactly. Jeremiah, I mean, you see, what we're talking about here is you just long, long list of the fact that God was so concerned, and there may be so many others that we're just not aware of because God didn't bother to tell us, but the very fact that God was so concerned about the godless Assyrians that he sent a prophet to Nineveh. Are you kidding me? Why do you think Jonah went the other way? He says, I don't want those disgusting people being saved. They murder people. They just rip women open. They do. They're horrible. We don't want them to be saved. He says, I'm not doing it. It's just like, eh. And God's going, I love them. What a message. What a message for us. How do you feel about Islamic terrorism? How do you feel like a Muslim in your neighborhood? How do you feel like about the... I know myself. I don't have good feelings. Like, I feel like you're here to take over. Well, that's not true in most cases. But we need to be aware of our feelings and the way we act that way, because we can be the same way. And so this is a very, very important principle that we notice here. God does not leave himself without witness. I want you to notice his witness now. For he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. As I was studying this, it just hit me. We have, living in our country, a bunch of godless Lyconians who don't understand that nature doesn't provide us rain and fruitful seasons, and all the food, and all the blessings. Nature doesn't do it. God is the one who gives it. God has given a witness to you. Every generation, Lyconians, every generation, God has faithfully provided for you. Rains in due season, giving you each of these things. So guess what? You don't have to worry about climate change. Climate's always changed, but you don't have to worry about it, even if it were going cuckoo, which it's not. But anyway, who's saying these things? People who are pagans. People who put their trust in us, who are so powerful that we can control the climate of the world. But such a And you know, I want to be good to the environment like anybody else. But that's not the issue here. The issue is, who's God? He's done it always. God has always provided this. And I just struck me as I was looking at this. That is so godless to think that somehow something's going to happen where God's not going to provide. He's always given witness. What's he doing? This is a witness to God. And what do? well, it's Mother Nature, it's this, it's that. We use every term we can possibly use in order to take away from God, who is the one who is doing this. He is still giving witness by, for he did good, God's doing good, by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons and satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. God is the one who's doing that. Even if you're a pagan Lyconian, God's doing that. I just thought that was powerful. Other than that, I didn't have much opinion. Or a United States citizen. That's exactly right. What a beautiful statement. Even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them, but Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, so here we go, Jews again, Jews doing this, persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the disciples gathered around him, he rose up, entered the city, and on the next day he went on with Barnabas to Derbe. And when they had preached the gospel in that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and Iconium to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples. Stop. Okay, so here he's stoned. They think he's dead. They drag him out of the city and they leave him there. Can you just see that scene? Here's the disciples coming out and they're standing around him. And I just kind of picture them going, well, what do you think? What are we going to do? All of a sudden, Paul comes to and goes, okay, boys, back to the city, and let's go to the next place and preach the gospel.
What do you think folks thought when he walked into the city?
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking they didn't see him walk into the city. He probably put a hoodie on, but bruised and beat up and the whole thing. I would say it would be hard to not believe this was just a miraculous healing, to have been stoned right to the point of death, or even death, we don't know. And then suddenly he just comes back and okay. So as much as that's true, that still hurt. There's still a lot of bruises and all of that. And yet he just gets up and says, all right, we got another city to preach to. And he just keeps right on going. What a bulldog-pointed effort to get the gospel out. That's something to remember, isn't it? Okay? When you and I try to talk to others about the Lord, you're sometimes going to get some real nasty reactions. And most of the time not, but sometimes. Well, I can't dissuade you. At least they didn't stone you. But you do see that picture. So then he travels back through. Now, by the way, a little mention of Luke, they went to Derbe. That's 93 miles from Lystra. Okay, everybody in tune with walking 93 miles. And then they go all the way back to Antioch, from Derbe back to Lystra, back to Iconium, back to Antioch. That's 200 miles. So that's all walking. Woo-hoo. Just keep walking. Days and days and days of that journey. So all of that. So next week we'll talk a little bit about this final part about the appointing of elders and a few things like that. And then we're going to get into chapter 15. So read ahead, please. Note everything you can in chapter 15 and we'll get into that.